This episode is brought to you in part by The Table Podcast from the Hendricks Center at Dallas Theological Seminary. I'm Daryl Bach, one of the hosts, and I invite you to join us as we discuss issues of God and culture, which includes anything and everything. Listen on your podcast app or at dts.edu/thetable.
You're listening to Quick to Listen. Each week we go beyond hashtags and hot takes to discuss a major cultural event. I'm Morgan Lee, Associate Digital Media Producer here at Christianity Today, and I'm with our Editor-in-Chief, as usual, Mark Galley.
Hello.
Hey, Mark.
How are you doing today? I saw you bike in.
Yes.
Carry your bike up the stairs.
You opened the door for me. Thank you so much. I couldn't have done it without you.
You listeners need to realize this woman is a mega athlete recently. Swimming, biking, running.
I mean, yes, I finally did my triathlon. It was on Sunday.
Oh, you did your triathlon.
Yes.
Great. And you finished, obviously, and you're alive.
And yes, you will do it next year because it's not that hard and you can do it.
Yes, ma'am.
All right. See you there.
Okay.
All right. Who's joining us today?
Joining us today is John Armstrong. He's president of Act 3 Network, a ministry for empowering leaders and churches for unity in Christ's mission. As such, John has been involved in evangelical Catholic dialogues for many years now, and his most recent book is Costly Love, The Way to True Unity for All the Followers of Jesus. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Mark. It's good to be here.
Good to see you again.
And you.
We see each other about once every 3 or 4 years at some event or other, so I've admired John's work in his various capacities in his life.
Thank you. Good to meet you, Morgan. I've listened to your podcast more than a few times.
Ah, that's why he was familiar with Precious Moments.
Yes,
he's like, oh, it's my turn to do it now.
I've often wondered, what would I say?
And now you have the opportunity to know. Well, we're glad that you're here, John, and it's going to be really interesting to be able to talk about what's going on in the Catholic Church right now. So let's kind of give our listeners a sense of what we will be getting into today. The Catholic world is reeling after a devastating month of sexual abuse revelations. At the beginning of August, a Pennsylvania grand jury reported that hundreds of priests abused at least 1,000 children since the 1940s and that dozens of church officials covered it up. The allegations were more heinous than much of what has been divulged in earlier sex abuse claims. The details, honestly, are too horrific to describe here, but suffice to say that the criminal behavior included everything from groping to rape. This past week, a prominent archbishop claimed that Pope Francis knew about and covered up the actions of Theodore McCarrick, a former cardinal who's been accused of sexually harassing adults and seminarians and abusing a child. This week on Quick to Listen, we want to understand the nature and extent of the abuse in the Catholic Church and how it affects Protestant and especially evangelical churches. So we have some really heavy stuff to get into today. And before we embark on this conversation, I want to remind everyone that this podcast is made possible by everyone who subscribes to Christianity Today magazine. Mark, I think you wrote something in the most recent issue,
It was the best piece in the recent issue, in my opinion.
If you would like to know what it's like to work
no,
for Mark,
actually,
there you go.
Exactly. It may or may not be the best piece, but it's an essay, an editorial called In the Beginning is Silence, and it addresses the great strength of evangelical faith and the great witness, which is our activism. And very often we're tempted to just, we see a problem, whether it be spiritual or social or whatever, and we want to attack it. And the encouragement in the essay is, let's remember from where we get our strength and our wisdom, and that is from the Lord himself, and that a life of activism requires a great deal of silence and quiet and prayer and listening.
Easier said than done.
Easier said than done for
but
people who want to solve problems. Yeah.
We're a community of fixers.
Exactly.
Well.
But we first have to be fixed by someone else before we can fix others. So that's the purpose of prayer, it seems to me.
All right. So if you'd like to be chided by Mark.
Gently, graciously.
A winsome rebuke. That's what he wrote. You can do so by becoming a subscriber of Christianity Today magazine. And again, you can do that by going to orderct.com/quicktolisten, orderct.com/quicktolisten. Again, as usual, we know that many of you have subscribed as a result of listening to the podcast, and we are so thankful to you for doing that. All right, Mark, it is time for our gut check. And boy, I imagine that you probably had a visceral response like I did to all of this information.
I did. I guess my visceral reaction was deep, deep disappointment and almost despair. because anyone who's read my writings know I have a deep admiration for a lot of things Catholic, especially Catholic spirituality. It has a tremendous and long history. Obviously, Protestants have some significant disagreements with Catholics, but it's a when push comes to shove, I've considered it a great and noble institution of the church. And to see something like this happen to any part of the church is just can lead one to despair. It makes one wonder if there's any future. Now, I happen to know there is, but that's what you feel. That's what I feel when I first get started.
So this report came out of Pennsylvania, and some people that listen to the show know that I went to school in Pennsylvania, and so there's something about just recognizing some of the geographic locations named that can make something feel like it hits more home, too. So I think that that was part of the reason why I had a more emotional reaction than that if this had happened in some place like Kansas, for instance. I know in our summary that we went over at the beginning of the show, we talked about not wanting to go into some of the details, but the details are really where you feel the most nauseated by just like the level of depravity that's in there and the level of cruelty that was inflicted. Yeah, I mean, in Spotlight, at least, which is kind of how I learned more of the history of the sex abuse scandal in Boston, I don't think they really necessarily get into what the abuse was like itself so much as what the repercussions of that abuse was and how it affected people's lives. But the kind of way that some of these priests seemed to torture children was really awful to read about.
Yeah, and then I think that was balanced with the cover-up by high church officials. It was equally disturbing to me that these bishops who are responsible for the care and feeding of the flock of Christ basically not only covered it up, but in many instances perpetrated it. So it was a kind of a double whammy.
I talked to a friend on Sunday who told me that one of the priests that was named in the report was someone that showed up to her first communion that was there. So just weird things like that, too. That feel
yeah,
like they
and
really...
a good friend of mine who I meet with every week in a theology group, he said McCarrick was a bishop in his diocese at one point, had a dinner in his home, and his head is spinning now, too.
I just also am always blown away by the level of like cognitive dissonance, because when you're talking about priests, you're talking about people who are serving communion and baptizing babies and doing all of these things that seem so humane and loving and caring of other people. And to know that they were capable of sadistic things at the same time.
Although we should be fair, some of them are capable of it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's fair.
But any are is shocking.
Yeah. All right. Well,
okay, let's
John.
Get into it, John. Now that we've presented the depressing picture.
I think it's only going to get a little bit more depressing, though, because we learned some of these more details. John, I'd like you to kind of start with us about when this Catholic sex abuse scandal actually started.
Well, the grand jury investigation in Pennsylvania, which was brought about by the civil authorities for the first time in America directly getting involved in this crisis. So a grand jury was convened in 2016. And it met for the course of 2 years and issued its report recently. And the grand jury found 301 priests or episodes, over 1,000 people that were abused. The report goes back, as you indicated in the opening, all the way to the 40s, 1940s. It's interesting, however, to balance this, that since 2008, they only identified two such sex abuse crises in the state. So that should at least caution us to say that what happened in the 40s, 50s, and 60s is continuing in the same way with the same number of priests, with the same coverage or cover-up that was a part of the past. I mean, the cover-up is not the same. I mean, we can say the problem is not completely rooted out. That would be accurate. We can say that there are still priests who should be disciplined and who I think are in most cases being disciplined as best we can tell. But the grand jury really covered it. My point is covered more than my lifetime, which is almost 70 years in terms of its investigation. And a reason for that is the statute of limitations. So the civil authorities have their hands tied by states, and each state has different statutes and different ways of doing this. But the state of Pennsylvania wanted to open its own investigation to go backwards to give some civil redress to an issue that fell under the statute of limitations. So that's what prompted it, as far as I can tell. That's what they found in their report. And the response of the six dioceses, which are suffragan dioceses to the Archbishop of Pittsburgh, which may be strange terminology, but it basically means they're overseen by the Archbishop of, or Bishop of Pittsburgh. Each of them gave their own reports, even before this grand jury report came out, acknowledging what was going on in their diocese and what they had found as well. And there's not a great deal of inconsistency between what the church reported during these 2 years and what the grand jury found, which again says the church, it took the church a long time, in all fairness, to get to this point, but it has gotten to this point, and it is addressing the facts that the grand jury was also addressing.
I'm just curious, when we talk about the Catholic sex abuse scandal, I think many people before this grand jury report came out were thinking of Spotlight and Boston. Does it go back even further than that? I think just to make readers aware, if I'm correct, that sex abuse scandal broke in 2001, 2002. Yeah. Was this something that was not even seen as a big, you know, something that the Catholic Church was associated with before that time?
Great question. I think the answer to that is generally no. The Catholic Church before Boston and Cardinal Law and the case that's in the movie Spotlight from the Boston Globe, the Catholic Church had not, certainly not publicly, ever addressed this as a problem significantly. So it hit the Catholic Church as a bombshell. And it's been an unfolding progressive sort of movement towards where we are now. The grand jury looks back way before that, of course, as I've said. And you've mentioned Cardinal McCarrick, who has since resigned and the Pope accepted his resignation in June of this year. The Cardinal McCarrick episode, as you said in your opening comment, is actually not about pederasty or boys or any of this kind of, you know, the stuff that disgusts us the most. However, the charges against him are about his taking liberty sexually with seminarians who are adults. You know, Pope Francis accepted his resignation and came to the conclusion that there was truth in the accusation. So those are not, they are related, they're sex abuse, but one is sex abuse of adults and one is sex abuse of children. I'm only making the distinction because the evil and the horror of children is far more complicated than that of adults. And I'm not in any way belittling the sin against adults.
One other clarification question about the scope of what we're talking about. Since what happened in Boston and with Spotlight, has this been revealed to be mostly an American thing, or has this been something that's been shown to be global in scope?
It's global. It's global. And it's particularly acute in terms of the representation of it in the media in America. It's a double-edged sword in how the American media treats it. On the one hand, the American media is aggressive in pursuing stories and seeking to get them right on the whole. On the other hand, the American media doesn't have much understanding of the Vatican and how it functions. So you're dealing with an actual story that is of great interest to all of us who care about children in particular, but you're dealing with an institution that is somewhat like the Titanic. It's not easy to change or turn. That's not an excuse again, but it's the reality of the Vatican. And furthermore, the Vatican tends to look at media, especially before Pope Francis, as the enemy of the Vatican. And then you add to that the complicating factor that America, though I'm thankful, Mark, that we don't have as much of this today as we had when I was a child, but America has a long history of pretty virulent anti-Catholicism that runs through media, runs through churches, runs through reaction to Catholics and fears of Catholics. I think that's wonderfully changed in my lifetime and is still changing, but it hasn't entirely gone away. So those are factors in even how the media understands or fails to understand. I've read some of the media reports, and I think they're way off. And I've read a few reports last night and this morning online by media sources such as the Washington Post that are very excellent. The New York Times had a good piece. So I think the mainstream media has done a pretty good job, especially at the higher levels of media reporting on the story.
That's been generally true of their religion coverage in general. 15 years ago, it was very bad. And even on the world we know the best, evangelical world, they're doing a much better job, to the point that sometimes they break a story and we think, why didn't we break that story?
I'm wondering if you can kind of give us a sense of what our listeners should know about the Vatican and its power structure. And, you know, for those of us who are listening to things and we know that someone that's a bishop is important or someone that's a cardinal is important, but don't actually know what that means in real terms.
Well, the Vatican, I mean, I must say, until I was over age 50 as an evangelical pastor and thinker, I didn't understand the Vatican. I just saw it as a singular source of power and control over the church. It's really not. The ultimate, and most Catholics will say this about the church, the ultimate source of authority and power that the normal Catholic meets week to week is their priest, not the Vatican, not the structure of the Vatican, not even the Pope, though he's the Holy Father to all Catholics, but it's their father, their parish priest, that they have confidence in, that they have trust in, that serves in the sacraments, that is a part of their Catholicism, their Christian experience. So this is what makes this so difficult, is when it is the priest who's an abuser, it breaks all confidence and trust in the authority of the church, which extends ultimately to the Vatican, because this priest would not be ordained if it hadn't gone up, as it were, the chain of command and has ultimately the blessing of the Holy Father, who is the pastor of pastors or the shepherd of the whole church. Each priest is ordained in a diocese by a bishop. Each bishop has authority over that diocese, that area of ministry and church. And each bishop is usually in a region. I referred earlier to Pennsylvania and these suffragan bishops who serve under the sort of umbrella oversight of the Bishop of Pittsburgh, which would be the larger diocese in that region. So Erie, Scranton, et cetera, are connected. Those archbishops have responsibility for bishops, and then it goes from there to Rome. Mark, you said earlier, as we were talking off the record, but it should be on the record for our evangelical listeners, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, which comes out of Vatican II, every region of the world, so to speak, Latin America has a conference of bishops, U.S. has a conference of bishops, Canada has a conference of bishops. Those conferences are just what the word conference means. They're conferees. They get together to discuss things appropriate to the American Catholicism, but they don't have authority over the priest, the bishops, et cetera, in America. Ultimately, that authority over the American church, over its archbishops, its bishops, and its priests lies in the Vatican. So Catholicism, and I'll use a term that some won't know immediately, but because it's an episcopacy or an episcopal form of government through bishops, not an independent, autonomous kind of a church authority, it eventually goes to the top of the chain of command, if we want to use that term, and the Pope is at the top of that. Now, he has around him councils, groups, and so forth, that make up a huge staff that is part of an issue of reform at Rome.
Yeah, huge bureaucracy.
Is how do you manage this huge clerical bureaucracy in Rome? And one of the responses of this Pope, Pope Francis, was to appoint in May of 2015 a pontifical commission for the protection of minors, minors meaning minor children. And it's not widely known among most probably evangelical listeners to us that this is was appointed by Pope Francis, and this is an active commission, and it's headed by Cardinal Sean O'Malley of Boston, who replaced the cardinal who was removed, Cardinal Law, that is in the movie Spotlight. And Cardinal O'Malley gets the highest marks of almost anybody in America for having dealt with this head on and straight up. And he's the president of that commission, has just been chosen again to serve it for another term. So it is fair to say the Catholic Church has appointed a commission. One last thing I'll say about the Vatican and that commission is that the flaw so far, and neither Francis nor Benedict nor John Paul nor any pope has addressed this flaw, and that's what's coming out in the McCarrick charge in the last 72 hours, is that the Church has yet to do anything that really addresses the problem of bishops who have moved priests from place to place, as we now know, nor has it addressed the problem of, like, McCarrick, who's being charged with actual sexual molestation of seminary students. There's no structure in place to address what to do with bishops. There's a structure in place to address address priests.
So this commission is really to focus on priests.
It's to focus on priests.
I see.
So the charge against it is it's not enough yet. And I would agree with that. It's not enough. And I think one of the things that'll come out of this is the Catholic Church will be forced to do something either with this commission or something else to more directly address what are we going to do with our bishops and archbishops.
And is this commission composed mostly of clerics then?
No, it's composed of lay people, both men and women. It's definitely composed of people who understand the sex abuse crisis, even those who are counselors and others. So it's not just clerics, and it's not just people who would be sort of cover-up experts.
This episode of Quick to Listen is brought to you by the Christian Standard Bible, a translation that is both faithful to the original languages and really easy to read. Today, we are talking with Michael Card. He is a singer and songwriter, and he served as a stylist for the Christian Standard Bible. Hey, Mike, how are you?
I'm doing good, Maureen.
Mike, you said that you read the Bible like 15 times when you were doing this project. Can you tell me a time where, you know, on the ninth or 11th run through, you just read a verse and you were like, oh my gosh, I've never read it that way before?
That happens all the time, Morgan. When you read big blocks, even whole books at one sitting, you see that verse, not just in the context of the verses around, but in the context of the whole book. I mean, I've written books on each one of the Gospels, right? And when I was working through the CSB, I saw themes and structure I've never seen before. And I'm a big encourager in reading the Bible fast. It sounds almost sacrilegious, but I tell people it's great to meditate on one verse and one phrase, but you will see things when you read it from the first chapter to the last chapter of a single book that you'll never see otherwise.
You can learn more about the Christian Standard Bible at csbible.com/ct.
This episode is brought to you by Church Salary. Coming up with a reasonable salary range for church staff has never been easy. There are so many details to consider before setting compensation for church staff, and you're probably asking yourself questions like, are we paying too little or too much? What benefits do we offer employees? What's a reasonable housing allowance? Church Salary believes that offering competitive and fair compensation helps keep people in ministry. Using the expansive church-specific compensation database and powerful salary calculator tool, you can also make better compensation decisions so your staff can focus on their ministries. Start with Church Salary's annual membership today to run unlimited customized reports and get access to our member-only content. Ready to start making better compensation decisions? Get started at churchsalary.com.
If you're telling me that all that's really been done right now is to cycle in and out, you know, is to address the fact that like priests are doing these heinous things to young children, obviously that sounds like a very impressive first step, but it also sounds like one that's probably the politically easiest one to do, given that these people are, you know, committing criminal offenses and that they're also the lowest on the totem pole. It just seems to me that there's something that would make them not want to touch, you know, going after cardinals or bishops. And then that was some sort of like political compromise that was struck.
I think that's a fair observation. However, we must not downplay how difficult it was after 2001 to begin to deal aggressively with parish priests, both in schools and in parishes, especially as they were most guilty of molestation of young boys. There were some girls involved, but it was predominantly boys, as we know. And to remove those priests, I mean, initially that with a pattern in the 60s and 70s, and I think this needs a little context, the pattern in the 60s and 70s when these reports came to bishops, if they believed them, and they often did privately, there was no sunshine on this problem, but when they believed them, what they did was move them to another parish, give them some time off, get them some counseling, maybe send them to a retreat center to work on their spirituality and their practice and get some actual counseling about sexual practice, and then reappoint them. Now, it's easy for me to sit here and say, what a stupid thing to do. But I have to remind listeners that in the 1950s and 60s, before these things became, you know, the spotlight was put on all of us, schools, other institutions, hospitals, that abuse, I believe, is widespread. This doesn't defend the church, but it's widespread culturally. And until the 80s, and especially after 1990, we didn't really begin to address this widely as a culture either.
And the other thing is we recognize how deeply problematic sexual abuse is.
Exactly.
As a habit, as
exactly.
An addiction.
As an addiction.
We thought some prayer, some time off, some spiritual counseling, it's a result of stress. Give this person a fresh start. We believe in grace. I think that all makes intuitive sense in the 1950s and 60s.
That's my point, exactly.
Yeah. It isn't until we discover how deeply inbred
and here's
sexual
a good,
addiction
Mark,
is.
Mark, here's a good comparison or good analogy. In the 1950s and 60s, if you had a priest who was an alcoholic, and you had many of them, I don't know how many, but you had many, they were counseled. They were taken out of the active ministry. They were reassigned eventually when they were sober and they felt they were well enough to be reappointed. Most of us would say that's probably okay under most circumstances. That's how they viewed the sexual abuse problem because they didn't see the depth and the magnitude and the sociology and the psychology and the destruction of it, of other people, the way alcoholism is not. Alcoholism is wrong. You know, an active priest should not be an alcoholic, but it's not of the same category as the abuse of minors.
Right. So help me understand then, when we're talking about a cover-up, were they actively cover something up, or were they just following the best church and societal norms of how to address that at the time?
I think the short answer is both.
Okay.
There were cases that I think there was, and that's come to light since Boston and 01. There are cases where I think bishops, archbishops knew a whole lot more that they didn't act on, And they are culpable, I think, for that personally, regardless of culture and what's going on.
Were these crimes that they were committing? I don't know enough about state statutes. But
well, state statutes now generally require the immediate reporting of this as a criminal act. So at the time, it didn't require that. Okay. It does now. So which pushes us into the present. What would a present bishop do in America? And the answer is, if he doesn't turn it over to civil authorities, he's in trouble personally. Because he knows. The same is true of Protestant or evangelical pastors. I have more than a few friends who are evangelical pastors who've had to turn such cases over to authorities in their own church and their own staff. And they've done it. A wonderful story, if I can tell it real quick. I won't name the person, but most of our listeners would know this evangelical preacher, leader, thinker. And some years ago, he was in a diocese where the bishop became a friend of his privately. And the bishop had dealt with all this stuff. This was about 18, 19 years ago. He'd begun to deal with it. And this evangelical pastor got news one day in his office that his youth pastor was, you know, having sexual relations with some of the underage children in the youth group. So he'd never faced this. I mean, I can remember as a pastor when this first hit my desk and I thought, what in the world do I do? And I'd go to older pastors and they had no clue because they'd never dealt with it. So he said, I picked up the phone and called the bishop. He said, oh, hi. And they want a first name friendship. So he did the smart thing. He said, can I see you first thing in the morning? This evangelical pastor went over to the bishop and he said, what should I do? And the bishop said, number one, you have to tell the authorities. It's a civil matter. It's a felony. Number two, you have to call the leaders and the people of the youth ministry together. Tell them, you have to remove him immediately. You have to tell them why. And then you have to have an all church meeting and tell them what you've done. And then he said, you can come up for air, but you got to do that. And you got to do it very quickly. And he did that, and he said, I thank God I was a friend of the bishop. He saved me a lot of trouble. Yeah. So there's a case where an evangelical pastor of a megachurch learned from a bishop as a friend how to address the problem, because the bishop had too much experience trying to deal with it himself.
I would think it depends on the situation, whether it's a cover-up or standard operating procedure, or whether it's pastoral care. I mean, it'd have to go on a case-by-case basis. Certainly, what was going on in Pennsylvania, some of it was so horrific, you can't help but think it's a cover-up. It's an attempt to hide the sinfulness of the behavior and not just try to deal with it, to simply hide it and to allow it to continue.
And I think that's a function, to a large degree, of a clerical culture. You know, a culture of we don't tell on each other, we don't account for each other, we've been ordained, we have these unique sacramental powers and authority.
I think it's important for us to, those of us who are not as intimately familiar with the story, to understand the larger political climate in the Catholic Church right now. Maybe kind of bring us up to speed, but if you don't mind starting back when Pope Francis became Pope, since that, I think, is going to be relevant for how we're understanding things.
Well, when Pope Francis became Pope, and of course, there's lots of speculation about conclaves and what they think and what they do, and that's even come out in this letter from Archbishop Vigano, which has created the controversy of the last few days, charging the Pope with malfeasance and with wrong and suggesting he needs to resign, telling him to resign.
Specifically saying he knew of McCarrick.
He knew of McCarrick, and he actually not only didn't report it, he actually continued to allow him to do things that Pope Benedict. By the way, the letter he's published, if the 11 pages are read, he's attacking Pope John Paul II, Pope Benedict, and Pope Francis. So he's not just leveling Francis, but he's also a guy who has a history of saying things and doing things that are provocative, that are read in the Catholic Church by many as attempts to get this Pope to resign.
Yes, we need that context, right? I mean, we know who all the flamethrowers are in the evangelical world,
exactly.
But we don't always know
exactly.
Who they
Although,
are.
Although Robert Barron, who's an auxiliary bishop in L.A., was saying last night, when Vigano makes a charge, it's something to pay attention to.
Absolutely.
He's not just a rabble-rouser.
Absolutely.
No. He's a person who's had deep responsibilities, and when he says something, you at least need to pay attention.
And he has firsthand information and knowledge. He cited a source for what he said about the Pope, but he does have firsthand information. He was an insider. He's not an outsider. He's not a critic throwing flames from outside. So he must be taken seriously. But as John Allen, the Vatican reporter from America, says, he must be taken with a grain of salt, too. So that's not to cast aspersions simply on his political or social
views. It must be investigated.
It must be investigated. That's exactly right.
All right. So let's go back to Pope Francis.
Pope Francis became Pope. I mean, we can only speculate, and we won't know till probably we get something after he dies. But why did Pope Benedict step down? I mean, he didn't really tell us. And it was a bombshell and a shocker that a pope would resign in the modern era. It's never happened in the modern era. So his stepping down made it possible for them to appoint Francis. Most insiders will say that Francis was the runner-up for Pope in the conclave previous when Benedict was chosen. He got a significant groundswell of support. He had been the conference bishop for Latin America, and he'd been a leader in Latin America and highly respected in the Latin American Catholic Church. What we do know is that the conclave wanted an outsider, wanted someone who is a reformer, and wanted someone who would address this very issue in ways that John Paul II, his defenders will say he was aged and feeble and couldn't deal with it in the last years of his papacy, that Benedict wasn't able to get a handle on.
Who was also pretty old when he
was also fairly old. But then they make another pope who's pretty old, but he's known as a pretty more of a straight-on reformer. So I think if you're to level a criticism at Pope Francis, and it's a friendly criticism coming from me, it's that there's some evidence that certain parts of his attempts at reform in this area have not really taken the effect or given the direction that we hoped he would give. And there's no excuse for that. You know, we need to know what happened. We need to know why it happened. And we need his response, by the way, the other day of making no comment to the media about this in this letter is being interpreted by both sides as favorable and unfavorable. One side would say his no comment is saying to the journalist, if you'll do your job, you'll see the underlying tones of this accusation and judge it for yourself. And when you do your job, then I'll talk to you about it. Okay. On the other hand, the other side says, wait a minute, he could have just said, no, they're false. And then we'd have known he's not covering anything up. So what do you do? Well, if you're prudent, you wait, you hold your fire and you wait and you say there needs to be an investigation. So I agree with my friend Bob Barron very much.
So it is fair to say, though, that as, you know, his reputation as a reformer, Pope Francis has angered many conservatives in his church over things and maybe spent a lot of social capital in ways that maybe some people may feel weren't the wisest for him to go about reforming things. And so at this stage that we're at right now, is there a lot of tension in the church over Francis?
The only reports I've read from news media from the Vatican are this was a nuclear bomb when the letter from was published. It's unfortunate, even if it were true, and I'm assuming innocence until proven guilty, but even if it is proven true, it's unfortunate that it was released when the Pope was in Ireland, of all places, with all the difficulties in Ireland. The timing to me is not good. It could have been this week instead of last week. And he knows that. He's a capable servant of Christ in the church. So again, you know, we've had these difficulties in our churches with accusations, you know, the whole Me Too influence and what it's done to evangelical churches and pastors. How do we respond? Boy, we need a lot more wisdom and candor. And one could hope that this Pope will go back to the Vatican, consult with the right people and do the right things. But I'm waiting to see. I'm hopeful. I believe Francis has the right sense of things. I don't know his level of energy, his involvement and what he'll do, but I think he'll do the right thing.
One can understand how the Pope could call a commission to investigate bishops, well, priests first, but then bishops. But who's going to call for an independent investigation
of the Pope
and the Vatican?
Yeah. Well, that's a fair question. And the people who are the most committed to this story from inside the Catholic Church, who believe the Pope is probably guilty, believe that this is the greatest scandal in the church since the 16th century. They want to go back to the corrupt papacies pre-Luther and say, we're having the same thing again. I would just say as a historian, that's a stretch.
What do you think?
It's not a defense, but it's a stretch. To compare the corruption of the Borgia popes to Pope Francis is a major stretch. But they are making those kind of things. That kind of gives you a feeling for his opposition. On the other hand, there are people, if we have to use the word, on the left, who want to defend him at all cost, and they don't want any examination. They want to completely discredit the sources.
So it's become super polarized.
Yes.
I don't think the current pope is anything like the medieval and Renaissance popes.
Right.
Nothing even close.
No, children going to appear?
No. And they're vying for secular power and all that. But I do wonder if the nature and extent of the sexual abuse we're discovering in America, we've discovered in Ireland, I'm sure we're going to be discovering it in all parts of the world, is equal or not worse than the moral degradation of the papacy, meaning the larger bureaucratic structure of the church from the Middle Ages. It does strike me as, at one level, whether it's worse or better, it's really bad. It was really bad then. It's really bad now. And so on one level, that makes me as a historian go, okay, the church managed to work its way out of that with the Lord's help. Maybe they'll be able to work their way out of this.
And the Reformation.
Well, the Reformation was a huge part of it. It was basically a slap in the face saying, if you're not going to reform yourself, we're going to just go ahead and do something new.
And the Counter-Reformation, as a result, began to address those very problems in the Catholic Church. Just as in that time, the Catholic Church needed to reform particularly an issue, a problem, and did eventually in the Counter-Reformation. It needs something, maybe not a Counter-Reformation, maybe not a Council of Trent, but it needs something more serious than what it's done so far to address this problem globally, as you've said. But I would add to that, all churches have to address it because we now know that it's present in various forms in all our churches.
It's always fair to keep broadening it like that. We run the risk of pointing the finger with three fingers pointing back at us. Yeah.
So one thing that Mark and I have talked about as we've had all these different related Me Too discussions is the fact that theology a lot of times gets implicated as a particular reason why abuse happens. So in evangelical circles, people will look at complementarian theology and point to that as, you know, undergirding this larger patriarchal norms that have made it really easy for men to get away with sexual misconduct in the church. Or you'll have instances where egalitarians just didn't take seriously, you know, enough some of the moral warnings, I guess, that you might get from more conservatives. Though it is always interesting when we'll see similar things happen, you know, regardless of theology. So can you give us a sense here of what the discussions are that are being had with regards to how theology is either being wrongly or rightly applied and leading to this result?
You know, there are those, and I'm not among them, who believe the answer to all of this is for priests to marry. And that's a theological issue for the Catholic Church.
Which priests were allowed to marry
long time. Yes, they were. And I'm not a proponent of celibacy as a requirement for priesthood if I were making the decision. But it is a decision the Western Church has made. The Eastern Church has a different look on it, the Orthodox Church. Priests can marry, but bishops are not married.
And the goal behind that was because of not wanting to have an heir or trying to
No, it was a part of it politically and socially. But it's primarily, at least as it's come down to us now, it's primarily about the priest has one bride who is Christ. The priest has one service, which is the flock of Christ. And that having a wife would be a second bride or a kind of a rival, as it were. And having been a Protestant pastor happily married for 48 years, I can tell you that there's an element of truth to that because it was difficult for my children and my wife to be married to a minister fully engaged in his ministry. So the argument makes sense on one level, but when it's universally applied that all priests have to be ordained as celibate priests, it creates this backlash of, well, you know, I mean, I read somebody who yesterday said, until the majority of Western priests are married, I'm not going to listen to the church anymore. Well, that's a solution in somebody's mind, but I think that's one theological issue, celibacy and priesthood. Another one is the debate that is being waged very much running under all of this like a subterranean river is the question of homosexuality. And you've got a division in the church, in America especially, over how the church should respond to homosexual Catholics in general and priests in particular. In general, the argument has focused around a book, very popular and controversial book by the Jesuit James Martin, best-selling author. I read his book, and there's one line in the book in which he says the doctrine of the church, the teaching of the church on this is dogma. But his argument is the argument that the church should not reject people, it should not distance people, it should not trash people, and they're made in the image of God. It's a healthy pastoral argument for inclusiveness towards people who struggle with their gay identity. But there are a number of leading voices in the church, all the way to the Vatican, not Pope Francis from what I can see, but people in the Vatican and bishops in America. Some have actually come out in the last 24 hours and asked for the Pope to be investigated. Mark, as you've suggested, how would you do that? The Bishop of Tyler, Texas asked for that yesterday. There's a river running through this opposition that says this Pope is making it possible for people to be gay and be still involved in the Catholic Church. And that is a theological and moral issue. So there is a debate, and the debate has in America has focused on the three bishops he appointed as cardinals, namely Cardinal Supich in Chicago, Cardinal Tobin in Newark, and Cardinal Farrell, who left Dallas to go to Rome but was Bishop of Dallas. They have been outspoken in sympathy with the approach of James Martin, which is seen as the antithesis to the position of the more moral rigorist.
So when Martin says that church is dogma, what does he mean? What is the church's dogma?
The church's dogma is that that same-sex practice is wrong, morally wrong. I think the debate, as it does with evangelicals, may come down to a distinction such as we have evangelical theologians who are gay but who are celibate, several prominent ones who've written books. I think of my friend Wheaton grad Wesley Hill's Washed and Waiting, a very good book in my opinion. He's a professor of theology and a priest at Trinity School for Ministry in Pennsylvania. Wes is openly identified himself as gay, but as celibate, and argues for celibacy now. If he did that as a Catholic priest, he probably couldn't stay in the church in America. The church wouldn't tolerate that kind of openness about his sexual identity as being gay. This term disordered sexuality is still used in both positive and negative ways. So there's a term. We have theological terms, you know, like they become our words. You know, we use them almost as clubs and struggles over definitions and applications.
So there's a lot at stake. What are the wisest leaders saying should happen next?
Some years ago, as a result of all we've talked about, in America, there was a charter drafted called the Dallas Charter. It's very significant in modern Catholic American story of what we're talking about. And it put protections in place. And here are some of the things that were put in place. Zero tolerance for any crime committed against a child. That is the position of the church today. So much so that my Catholic friends who are involved in this will say the safest school in the city is a Catholic school. And I agree with them. I've looked at this carefully. And I would say that it's not to say it could never happen again, but what they put in place is so strong that public schools and people, you know, run Christian schools that are evangelical or whatever ought to look at what the Catholic Church has done. Zero tolerance and mandated requirement of turning people over to authorities. And then the second thing that was done, and Cardinal Bernardin did this in Chicago initially, was to put annual background checks from DCFS, Department of Child and Family Services, so that everyone who was employed, who worked with children, had a background check. Now, again, some of our evangelical institutions in the greater Chicago area have begun to finally do this in the last few years, but the Catholics did it first. Thirdly, they put in place safe environment protocols and special training for all clergy, staff, and volunteers, especially if they work with children. Fourthly, Cardinal Bernardin followed this protocol of Dallas and mandated reporting to civil authorities before any church investigation of allegations. So in other words, tell the authorities first and then do the church investigation, which is not what the bishops were doing, as we've said today. And then finally, he said the allegations need to be made to an independent review board with a majority of lay leadership. So that addresses the clerical issue. It addresses a lot of issues. And I think those are steps. Those are not only being practiced, but that protocol of transparent accountability and leadership is there. And then there's one other quote that a friend of mine gave me who's an eminent theologian and Catholic voice, and he's a dear friend. And he said, I talk to my seminarians daily, and I often ask them, how can you become a priest in this present sexual moral climate? And he says, they answer me, because I want to be part of a solution. And he says, I truly believe that these priests I'm training, or these students I'm training for priesthood will be a solution. So, you know, these things didn't happen overnight, and they will not be completely resolved overnight. But I would say the Catholic Church at the parish level is solving and has taken serious steps to solve the problem. And we could all, as Christians, learn from those steps and be proactive ourselves.
Yeah, I've been surprised at commentary by young Catholics at how aggressively they want to head into this problem and deal with it rather than just, I'm not seeing as much, well, I've had it with the Catholic Church. It's more like, this is horrible. We got to deal with it.
But I don't think there's any drop-off in seminarians. There's drop-off for other reasons, as there's drop-off in people pursuing the pastorate in our churches. But I don't think it's because of the sexual crisis that young men don't want to go in the ministry. And I don't think it's, though celibacy is a factor, I don't think it's perhaps more of a factor now than it would have been 50 years ago. These aren't the reasons for a fall-off in priestly candidates. But those who are in seminary, and I get to be with some of them, and I've been on campuses and talked to Catholic students preparing for priesthood, and there's great regard for dealing with this issue and wanting to be the answer to it.
I do think one issue of polity that I think was an interesting contrast, which would, when people think, oh, well, the problem with evangelical churches is they're too independent, they're not connected, and that's why we see signs of not wanting to hold themselves accountable, why there's sexual abuse in places like Willow Creek and others. But then we see it also in a church that's highly structured, highly hierarchical. And to Morgan's comment about we have people who are egalitarians who commit abuse, and we have people who are complementarians who commit abuse, it does seem to be something that transcends our theological and ecclesial boundaries.
Yes. I think that's perceptive, yeah. And I think it's absolutely right.
That's why I can't not believe in total depravity. Right? It was just funny when you create all these different systems or ways that you're going to try to, you know, often that are in good response to some other scene that you've seen somewhere.
And as you've said, the structures and forms of authority and the theologies of male and female and relationships and headship and all this is not an answer. because it transcends those answers.
That's what the Protestant church has shown us. We have another church going on the same time.
Yeah.
Similar issues going on.
And evangelicals are right to raise those questions. But if they're going to raise them of Catholics, then we ought to be honest and raise them of ourselves, of our own culture. And as you said in the opening, what is the strength of our culture and our Christianity, but what are some of the weaknesses that attend that? There was a really good story made by Sarah Pulliam Bailey, who's a respected journalist on religion.
Who got her training here at Christianity Today.
I know that. That's kudos to CT for producing such a good journalist.
There you go.
She's written a recent piece, and I'm quoting the title of it, "Evangelical Sex Abuse Record Worse Than the Catholic," says Billy Graham's grandson, Boz Tevikian, who teaches at Liberty University, of all things. And he says, our crisis is not in America, in our parishes. It's on our mission field with our missionaries.
Huh.
And he says the agencies, the mission agencies, will not face it for two reasons. Number one, they won't get visas for more missionaries to get in if they're expelled for this reason. And number two, they can't keep their donor support if they start admitting they're having problems on the mission field that are sexually based with children. And I must testify as an evangelical pastor in the city of Wheaton for 20 years that I had a woman in my congregation who was sexually abused as a child in a mission school by evangelicals. So this problem goes way back. She's my age. So she was born in 48, 49, 50. This went back to the 1950s. So, you know, this is not simply a Catholic issue. It's a culture issue, and it's a moral issue for Christians, Catholics, Protestants.
We've covered just a little bit of that in CT, but Boz is suggesting is that there's many more cases to be exposed.
There is something about the fact that we can call this all the Catholic Church and everyone's kind of more officially connected in an easily recognizable type of way that does kind of help us understand and see the scope of the scandal in a way that the Protestant Church, because it has so many churches, denominations, and parachurch organizations
acting independently, yeah.
It all becomes the name of the name of the ministry with the scandal, as opposed to calling it the Protestant Church sex abuse scandal.
I'd like to tell a very, very quick story because it's as personal as last week, 5 days ago, of a man who grew up in the Chicago area, Catholic, went to Catholic school. And in first grade, he was sexually touched and addressed by a nun. Now, I'd never heard this story, but it was a sister who did this to him. And he described it to me as explicitly as I'd ever want to hear such a story. And the long story made short was he said to me, my life, my marriage, my children, he had at this point teenage children, older teenage children. He said, I realized I could not respond to women the right way. And I didn't exactly know why. And he began to go back into his past. And it led him to go to the Archdiocese of Chicago. And it led him into the office which deals with this issue. And he said, I had no desire for money or compensation, but I had to find peace and I had to find somebody to forgive and I had to deal with it as a Christian. And he did. And the story of the Archdiocese and what they did, two women actually took his story. And one, who was the lead on the investigation, is a graduate of one of our evangelical schools. I don't know if she's Protestant or not. She well could be, actually, because the Archdiocese will employ Protestants to work in things like this. But she was a graduate of one of our Chicago area evangelical schools. And when I saw her name and where she went to college, I said, do you know the connection here? He didn't. I said, this is pretty significant that the Catholic Church in Chicago was open to dealing with you this way because of even this kind of influence and this kind of counsel and reaching out, which leads me to this, as you led in and talked about my calling, Mark. My calling is in this ecumenical space of working for Christian unity. I believe that if we don't pursue more Christian unity and listen to each other on an issue just like this, we won't overcome it. We need our Catholic friends to help us here, and we need to serve them as well here. And so if anyone's heard what I've said, that's the spirit behind it all, is how can we serve the greater good of the kingdom of God and the whole Church of Christ, though we're in this divided state as Protestants and Catholics?
I would say a big amen to that. Unity has been an increasingly important theme in my writing. I see our own movement, evangelical, divided all for all sorts of secondary reasons, and it's deeply disturbing. So it's even more disturbing when we talk about the Church Universal.
All right, John, it was really great to have you run us through all of that and just help our listeners make sense of it. And as a reminder, if people have feedback that they want to give for the podcast, you can email us. We're at podcast@christianitytoday.com. You can also go on Twitter and let us know what you think there. We're on Twitter at CT Podcasts. All right, now is the time of the show that we call Precious Moments. Everyone gets to share something that has brought them joy in the past week. Mark, I'll throw it to you.
Pergola. That's what brought me joy. I built a pergola for our patio.
That's awesome.
Sunday and today, yesterday. So, it's one of those projects. It's the two main posts that
stabilize it have been in place for 2 summers. And I finally got around to building the pergola that goes on top of it. So that's always, as listeners know, that's one of the great therapies I have, is doing a project that's very manual, physical.
What was the hardest part about building it?
Making sure everything was level before I started actually tacking things on. Once that was done, it took a couple hours, really.
That's awesome.
I mean, and there's sawing and all that, but you want to make sure it's absolutely level all around. Otherwise, you look at it later and it looks weird.
Well, congrats on finishing a 2-year project. All right, where can people find you?
I publish something called The Galley Report, which can be found at christianitytoday.com/The Galley Report, G-A-L-L-I, by the way, which I link to and comment on articles I find of interest.
All right, John?
The most special moment in the last week was this conversation that I referred to earlier with this man who told me his story. And he actually came to me. This is what makes it especially joyful. He came to me because he engaged with me on my Facebook. I learned years ago, a couple years ago, to just stop Facebook unless I knew the person. It just didn't work. And he put something up that was, I don't know him well, but I knew him through a second friend. But he put something up that challenged me. And my first response is as typical of Facebook, is, how dare you challenge me, in my opinion. Then I wrote, and a couple other people thought he was attacking me, so they defended me. And then he pressed a little further. And then the friend who introduced him to me contacted him and said, I don't know what's going on. And he told him what's going on. And he said, you need to go see John and have lunch with him rather than talk to him on Facebook. And he did. And the result was him telling me the story about his long journey to complete healing and reconciliation by approaching the Catholic Church over what happened to him as a first grader. And I think the story that's precious to me is that you can use the social media, but if you don't keep it personal, if you don't pursue the person, it all becomes just back and forth, more partisanship, and it doesn't solve any problems.
And at the same time, it can bring people together.
Absolutely. So. Absolutely. I think this guy's a friend of mine for life now.
Oh. So where can people find you after they're done listening to this podcast?
The Act 3 Network, which I began 27 years ago, has I'm retiring as president, have retired. It's not official yet, but it will be in a few months. And it has become, as I'm leaving and saying on the way out the door, I don't think you should choose a successor. I think you should let the ministry die. The board said, well, okay, we'll do that, but we want to resurrect something different entirely without you being the head or you being the key to it. And they've created what amounts to a community for mission ecumenism, or missional ecumenism, we call unity in the mission of Christ. And that community is made up of Orthodox, Catholic, and Protestant Christians. And we met at Green Lake Conference Center this summer, and we've now incorporated, and we are officially The Initiative. So you can go to theinitiative.org and find us and what we're doing. It's exciting. We've already dealt with or beginning to deal with ethnicity and race and other issues that generally I find churches don't deal with very well. And yet we've been blessed with an influx of people from all traditions and races and backgrounds who want to find unity in Christ. It's just a little small drop in the ocean, but it's, I think, an important drop at this time. And I'm delighted to see what happens when I retire.
Actually, it's more than a significant drop in this respect. I think one of the faults of the conversation about diversity in America and diversity in the church and evangelicalism is that most people don't realize it's only the first step towards something else. And that unity is actually the thing that the Bible calls us to. It assumes diversity. You can't have real unity unless you have diversity. Otherwise, it's uniformity. But diversity is only a goal on the way to something else. So you're already on that way to something else. So that sounds great.
I'm on that road for many reasons, but a major reason is Christianity Today.
Oh.
And it's Jim Packer.
That's true. He was a model of that.
Yeah, he was. And CT being involved in the evangelical Catholic conversation, which was controversial. And when I started back in my early days, I was an enemy of that approach.
Oh, how about that?
And through friendship with Jim and people at CT and a long journey, I'm a friend of it now.
Wow.
And that's the rest of the story.
That's quite a testimony.
That's a conversion story.
Thank you.
It is.
Are you on Twitter?
I am, at JohnA1949.
Very good. All right. I guess my precious moment is the triathlon, just because I've been talking about it for so long on the podcast.
So how'd you feel when you finished? Physically first, not emotionally.
I felt okay. Like, I probably could have run a couple more miles if I really had to. It was really hot. I think when I got in the water at 6:15, I want to say it was probably in the mid to high 70s at that point, and really muggy. And it kind of stayed muggy.
This is on Sunday?
Right.
It was a hot day. Oh, brutal.
It was one of the most muggy days.
Like 100 degrees field temperature, yeah.
Yeah, and I what I learned later is they actually kind of truncated the running section for some of the athletes who got in later because they didn't want them to run 6 miles. So yeah, the triathlon is incredibly beautiful though. You get to swim in Lake Michigan, which people I think have heard me say I love swimming in Lake Michigan. And Lakeshore Drive, for people who don't live in Chicago, is basically this, I don't know, highway that runs along the lake, and they shut down the southbound part of Lakeshore Drive, and your race or your the bike portion of that is all on Lakeshore Drive, which is awesome when, you know, it's 7 o'clock in the morning. I love it. And don't have to worry about cars or anything like that. Just, you know, about bikers coming up behind you at 25 miles an hour, you know. But yeah, it's a great view and way to experience the city as well. All right. People can find me on Twitter at MEPAYNL. That is it for us this week. Thank you, everyone, for listening to another episode of Quick to Listen. This podcast is made possible by everyone who subscribes to Christianity Today magazine. Again, you can do that by going to orderct.com/quick to listen. This podcast is produced by myself, Richard Clark, and Cray Allred. You can get this podcast almost anywhere you get your podcasts. We love it, though, when you go onto Apple Podcasts and rate and review the show. Thank you to everyone who has done that. We will see you all next week.